We're talking about the July 7th issue of the New York Times Book Review. Many of us read the headlines about five young women who were found murdered on Long Island a few years ago. Robert Kolker is here to talk about his new book, Lost Girls.
These women's lives were a window into a world that the media doesn't often write about.
What is our fascination with villains? And are they always such bad guys? Chuck Klosterman will join us to talk about his new book, I Wear the Black Hat.
As a person grows older, they feel and understand the idea of a villain kind of more intimately.
Mortality Memoirs. Megan O'Rourke joins us from Paris to talk about writers writing about their own deaths.
Writers document death in real time.
The two biggest giants in publishing have just joined forces. Julie Bosman has notes from the field. And Greg Coles will give us a rundown of the bestseller lists. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
I am here with Robert Kolker, who is the author of a new book, Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Pamela.
So this story really is about five women, all of them murdered. What were the circumstances?
These are five women whose bodies were all discovered near one another in and around Gilgo Beach, Long Island, which is sort of a desolate part of the south shore of Long Island on your way out to Fire Island or the Hamptons. It's a place that's very quiet at night, and so it's, you know, in hindsight, a place that might be a perfect place for a serial killer to leave bodies. But Lost Girls isn't just about the killer and the murder mystery. It's about the lives of these women. And I thought with this book it would be important to try something different there, to try and understand exactly what makes women like these so vulnerable.
And they were all prostitutes.
Yes, they all advertised on Craigslist and Backpage. And when I first started reporting on this case for New York Magazine, I was surprised by their lives. I had thought that perhaps they had been trafficked in from another country and that we'd never learn their identities, but in fact they defied expectations in a lot of ways.
How did they defy expectations?
Well, they were close to their families, and they were, you know, leading pretty much, you know, more or less functional working class lives, and they all were from struggling places that were not New York City or Long Island, places a good distance away, and they all came to New York to work on Craigslist because the money was so dramatically different from what they could ever hope to make anywhere else. And I finally decided that these women's lives were a window into a world that the media doesn't often write about.
So, I mean, Craigslist and the internet in general play a big part here in terms of how the technology has transformed prostitution. What's changed?
It's easier, for one thing. Someone who never once would have given a second thought to walking down the street and being an escort now has the option of just posting ads on Craigslist, and
that made
a difference.
Low-risk entry.
Exactly. The barrier to entry is lower than ever, and there's also anonymity on the internet, which not only helps escorts, but helps Johns and helps all of us who want to do anything on the internet. I mean, the NSA aside, you can go on Yelp and put a comment on anonymously, or, you know, another person can, you know, sell stolen goods, you know, anonymously, or in the case of prostitution, there's been a huge boom online because people feel safer. But of course, you know, in the case of these women, they weren't safe at all.
So these five women, were they all killed? What was the timing here? When did this happen, and how close together were the murders?
The first of the five women I wrote about disappeared in 2007, and then another in 2009, and then three in 2010.
And the subtitle of the book, of course, is an unsolved American tragedy or mystery, is a tragedy. Did you think going into writing the book that this would be solved, that this would end up being a kind of court case book?
I really felt that even from the beginning that the book could work as a true crime book and as a social issues book. I'm a huge fan of Alex Kotlowitz and Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc and also David Simon, and I really felt that looking at these women's lives would be an eye-opening exercise, even if a killer wasn't caught. And of course, nothing would make me happier if there were an arrest in the case, and these women deserve justice, but at the same time, they deserve understanding. I don't think anyone, you know, of your viewers really would remember the name of any of Joel Rifkin's victims or even David Berkowitz's victims or the Zodiac Killer's victims. And so this book is really meant to be a sort of a corrective to that.
I know with Kotlowitz, he also did a book that ended up, it was an unsolved crime. How do you, in terms of structuring your narrative and your story, kind of deal with the fact that there isn't an ending in that sense?
When I got going, I knew that the first half of the book would be about the women's lives before they disappeared. So it would be five biographies of five women and their families. And that the second half of the book would then be a look at everything that happened after they disappeared. And if there was an arrest in the case, then so much the better. But if not, it would be a hard look at their friends and family's lives and how they cope and how the media looks at it. I worked on the finer points of structuring the story later on, but I knew from the beginning it would be like that.
And also perhaps why there wasn't an arrest, right? I mean, what, when these women were killed, was there sort of a huge outcry when they were found out to be prostitutes? Did that affect the investigation in any way?
That's another very good question. I think the thing to point out here is that there was a lot of victim blaming going on here, and that nobody stopped and thought about why the police didn't care when these women went missing in the first place, and why the police, once they discovered there was a serial killer on the loose, were at such a disadvantage because these disappearances hadn't been investigated. Then again, why the police didn't even offer immunity to other prostitutes who might have known these women. There's a huge willful ignorance of prostitution in our society, and even if there's not decriminalization, there at least should be, you know, a way for women not to have to work in the shadows, you know, to be offered immunity during an important investigation. That's one of the arguments the book makes, but mostly it's a narrative. It's a story about five women and their families.
And in going back to that criminal investigation, in your reporting, did you find fault with the way that police conducted the investigation? You mentioned not interviewing or not offering immunity to other potential witnesses.
You know, they changed their theories openly and out loud publicly, which I think they would say now was a huge mistake because it hurts them if they ever have to prosecute the case. They also said publicly not to worry, it's just a bunch of prostitutes, which, you know, is not the nicest thing in the world to do.
I'm assuming you've talked to the families of these women. How were they affected by this investigation and by the way the media handled it at the time?
I'm glad you asked that question because this book wouldn't have been possible without, you know, the generous cooperation of these families. And they all, you know, their lives have been turned upside down by what's happened here. And, you know, they weren't the ones who put themselves in danger. And yet they were willing to talk to me and offer a window into their lives and their worlds. And I'm very, very grateful to them.
Was it hard to get them to kind of let you in and open up to you after the treatment that their daughters had had?
It was. In the beginning, they were very interested because they didn't want their loved ones' cases to go cold. And I did a cover story for New York Magazine that brought the families together. But after a while, you know, they're working 9-to-5 jobs at Walmart or at Domino's, and they can't take time off to go and be a part of things like this. Their lives have been interrupted enough. And so I really had to, you know, prove myself all over again and let them know my intentions were pure.
Now, these were obviously five different women from very different circumstances and families, but was there one kind of unifying message that the families had or desire that they had in having you tell this story?
They are caught in a bit of a catch-22. They want the world to know about their loved ones, and they want the killer to be caught, but they also don't want their loved ones to be typecast purely as prostitutes. All of these women were more or less in their mid-20s. They all had a lot of time ahead of them. You know, who knows what other things they would have done with their life. And you learn a lot about them in Lost Girls. You learn that they're more than just what they chose to do for a year or two. And so that, I think, is something they would really like to have put across.
Thanks, Bob, for telling this story. The book, again, is Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery, which tells the story of an unsolved murder of five women on Long Island.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power by John Meacham. That's Thomas Jefferson, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So tell us about the huge publishing merger.
Well, this week we've had a major change in the setup of publishing companies. There's no longer the big six. We're going to have to go down to the big five. Penguin and Random House have officially merged after announcing that the two companies were going to combine back in October. Now that all the regulatory approvals from the United States, from countries in Europe, China, Brazil, now that all of those approvals have come through, Random House and Penguin have officially combined as of July 1st.
So, I mean, we think of this as two of our American New York-based publishers, but in fact, Penguin is a British company or was a British company, and Bertelsmann was a German company. Explain how that all worked out and sort of who ended up on top.
So Bertelsmann is the parent company of Random House, and Pearson, which is really known more for its educational publishing, is the owner of Penguin. And it was those two parent companies that said in October that they wanted to merge their publishing assets. So under the new company, which will be called Penguin Random House, Bertelsmann would control 53% of the company, and Pearson will control 47%, and no money exchanged hands in this deal.
Now, Pearson used to own The Economist, right, as well? Did they spin that off, or is that now part of this somehow?
That's not part of it. Pearson still owns the Financial Times as well.
Okay. So who is the new CEO of Random House?
So the new CEO of the new company is Mark Ostola, who was the chairman and chief executive of Random House. So he has really been kind of the spokesperson for the new company. He was first appointed chief executive of Random House in 2008. So he's not someone who started in the mailroom at Random House and worked his way up. He was in Germany, and he is, of course, German, and he's been living in New York since he's been the chief executive of Random House. And he has a very good reputation. He's thought of as, a very savvy executive. And he's known for making very deliberative, almost slow moves, for taking his time. So it'll be an interesting culture combination, I guess, with the two companies now that he'll be leading more than 10,000 employees, 250 independent imprints, and a company that will produce about $3.9 billion in annual revenues.
Now, publishing is already a very incestuous industry, and not a huge industry, getting ever smaller. But this is particularly interesting because these two parties were kind of the big guys in New York publishing. And you've had publishers and editors who've left one for the other kind of in a huff. So What is this? What's going to happen here? I mean,
it's very interesting because Random House was the world's largest trade publisher and Penguin was right behind it. So you have now these two enormous players that have combined. And for the employees of these companies, you know, there's always this endless game of musical chairs in the publishing industry. You have a lot of editors who have left one house for the other and go back and forth. You have very prominent editors like Ann Gotthoff, who left Random House and probably would never return under normal circumstances, and went to Penguin. It now runs her own imprint, the Penguin Press, at Penguin, and now she's back working at Random House. And there are dozens of examples like that of people who left one company for the other and are now kind of awkwardly reunited with their former employer.
But they're not going to be cozying up in cubicles next to each other, right? Yet.
Not for a very long time, it seems. I asked Mark Ostola if he was going to combine the two, and there are a lot of reasons why they're not going to be working out of the same building right away. First of all, both buildings have very long leases, so they really couldn't move into a new building together. But I also think that one of the talking points, it seems, of this merger is continuity. Random House and Penguin are both going to operate very much like they did last week before this was finalized. They're going to stay in their own buildings. There is no talk of layoffs or closing down imprints.
But what does this mean for readers? I mean, is this good news? Is it bad news? Are there going to be fewer books?
I think right now the impact on consumers is, it's unclear, but it seems like there won't be an immediate impact, or perhaps one for a very long time, perhaps even years. I think that Random House and Penguin executives are saying that they're still going to publish the same number of books. The books that have been acquired are still going to come out as planned. They're not going to be reevaluating all of their contracts and deciding which books are going to come out. They really want business as usual, and they want editors to keep buying books, and they want everything to keep operating as it was.
But a lot of authors and agents, but really authors, are nervous about this. What's the fear?
The fear for authors and agents is a less diverse marketplace. You want as many publishers out there as possible who are willing to buy your book. And with the combination of two publishers into one enormous publisher, that means that there's just one fewer player out there.
Right, because when you're submitting a book proposal or a novel, you can only send it usually to one imprint in a house, or sometimes several imprints. But now these two players have, how many imprints do they have between them?
More than 250. And so if you are an author, there are really only a certain number of places that you can send your book if you want to get $1 million for it. You know, there used to be a half dozen. And what's unclear at this point is how the bidding process will work. Will Penguin bid against Random House? For now, that is still true. But eventually, we don't know if that will be true. So I think that, you know, agents and authors are a little nervous about what this means. That said, if you are an author who currently, you know, is with Penguin or Random House, you suddenly have like a bigger and more powerful publisher behind you with like a much stronger position in the marketplace.
They run now 25% of the market they control.
At least.
So it's less competition for authors in terms of them getting a big book deal or the editor they necessarily want. But the whole reason behind this merger was for competitive purposes.
Absolutely. I think that the executives at Pearson and Bertelsmann wanted to combine their publishing arms because they wanted to have more leverage against Amazon, which, you know, gains more and more power every year. And I think that what they want is to be able to have more strength when dictating their terms of sale. And they probably have a lot of other ideas for what they want to do with this new company. I talked to one analyst yesterday who suggested that they would open up mini bookstores, that they would have so many titles in, you know, between the two companies that they would be able to do a lot of things that they couldn't do before.
So we'll see what happens next time a case lands in the Supreme Court.
Indeed.
Thanks, Julie.
Thanks.
Chuck Klosterman has written a new book called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. Chuck is calling in from Fire Island, where it's probably very rainy right now. Hi, Chuck.
Hey.
So tell us about this book, Villains. Is it just about bad guys, or is there a different definition that you've got?
It's not as straightforward as saying it's just about bad guys, although I guess if we listed all the people sort of written about, it would seem like that would make sense as well. It more has to do with the idea of villainy, particularly in a mediated culture, and about the process of maturation, how, you know, when you're very young, you tend to almost, you know, fixate on heroic characters. You get a little older, you're sort of intrigued by the idea of an anti-hero, and when you're actually adult and you look at characters in the culture, whether they're fictional or non-fictional, it's almost as if you're trying to kind of understand yourself through these people. And as a consequence, I think that as a person grows older, they feel and understand the idea of a villain kind of more intimately.
Has that always been true? Is that kind of an eternal progression?
I think that it probably has, although the medium has sort of changed. I think in literature, you saw this, long ago, you know, in the 19th century or whatnot. Then in the 20th century, it kind of happened in film and in the 70s, particularly with rock music. And now over the last 10 or 15 years, you've really seen it sort of emerge in television. It's sort of like the main trope to high-end television tends to be problematic characters who are technically the protagonists. So I think that that sentiment probably has always existed, but sometimes it takes more time for certain mediums to adopt it for whatever reason, either technological or social or, you know. But in a broad sense, I think it probably is central to the experience of being alive. The idea that as you grow older, bad people start seeming not so bad.
They seem kind of good. I mean, who are the villains that you talk about, though, in I Wear the Black Hat?
This book is actually grouped, I suppose, almost thematically. Like, I think the most accurate description is that it's a collection of essays that are all fundamentally about the same problem. But, you know, I have one essay about how, like, the relationship of sex sort of informed this kind of relationship. So I talk about Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, but I also talk about the film Basic Instinct. I talk about sort of like Wilt Chamberlain in that section. I talk about Ted Bundy. You know, I have another essay on villains who, for whatever reason, are not villainized, that their actions seem problematic, and yet the way that they are viewed is almost like folk heroes are universally good. These are people like D.B. Cooper, Muhammad Ali to an extent. People whose messages are consumed differently by the audience because they express a degree of confidence or something that's admirable. I have an essay on Hitler. I have an essay that kind of looks at O.J. Simpson, particularly the book he wrote after his trial, If I Did It. I have an essay on technology where I talk about people like Julian Assange. Like all my work, it's kind of meandering. It's not really fixated. It's hard to argue that, well, this book is trying to make this singular statement. It's really kind of an exploration, and I guess sort of because they're personal essays, an exploration of myself.
What did you want to say that was different, or what was it that you had to say about Hitler specifically?
That was a particularly complex piece, because my initial assumption was I'm not going to write about Hitler for two reasons. One, been written about so much, and, you know, studied so much, you know, it's sort of almost like writing about the Beatles or something, where you're writing about something that doesn't really necessitate more comment. The other thing is, you know, I understand the danger of writing something that even just implies the suggestion of sympathy towards certain characters. I mean, with this book in general, I'm trying to empathize with the villains, and I was like, well, this is something you just don't want to do this with someone like Adolf Hitler. Then, whenever I mention this to Jewish friends of mine, they seem very aghast that I was leaving this out of the book and that I wasn't going to do this and that this would be sort of like an essential oversight. So, and I was in this weird position. It's like, how do you write about Hitler in a way where what you're saying is new, you know, like it's something that hasn't been written before and yet isn't necessarily going to sort of change the way the book is consumed by everyone. You know, how do you be interesting without being interesting almost? So it ends up being an essay sort of about the problem of writing about Adolf Hitler. And not just for me, but for Bob Dylan and for David Bowie. And the way that the meme of Hitler being outraged on the internet, there's a whole collection of YouTube clips that take a film about like the last days of Hitler, and then they edit it in a way that makes it seem like, you know, he's upset about the new Twilight movie. You know, why is this the way we handle Hitler? Sort of from the premise that every other tyrant or dictator can sort of be understood in the abstract, but Hitler is the one that we want to always understand in a personal way. That Hitler isn't just an idea. Hitler must be remembered as this real individual. And that creates a difficulty for those who sort of want to deal with him.
Now, on the polar opposite end of the spectrum, you take on Taylor Swift. Why is she a villain?
That was a section I'm really writing about the Eagles in that essay, about sort of how I've always been fascinated by the idea that certain things are, I guess, eligible to be hated almost arbitrarily. That you don't even need to give sort of a real cogent reason, you know. And the Eagles are one of these things, especially in the circle of rock critics, which I spend a lot of time involved with. It's almost assumed that the Eagles represent the worst extension of music. And I used to feel that way, too, until I realized that I wasn't doing this for artistic reasons or cultural reasons. I was just sort of injecting a kind of belief into their music and hearing something different. And I talk about how this also applies to a degree to Taylor Swift, who plays almost like an eagle-like role in contemporary music culture. She was someone who initially had, you know, made records that struck people as surprisingly good. She seemed surprisingly mature. And they wanted to sort of create a reason to appreciate her work, with an explanation that went outside purely saying the songs are good.
Right. Then she got too much credit.
Yeah. Well, they almost sort of created like a shadow figure, a shadow Taylor Swift that wasn't just a talented songwriter and a talented singer, but a representation of some idea about modernity. But then the next group of people who sort of learned of Taylor Swift, not as a musician, but as a celebrity, the kind of person who came to be aware of her because of Us Weekly or whatever, adopted all this other information that other critics had created and put that back into her music, and then they heard something totally different. To me, so much of this is just about what perception means in a world where our perception is constantly being tweaked and constantly being warped. And there's a meta dialogue going on with every dialogue we have, and someone like Taylor Swift really is a great candidate for that kind of discussion, because she does feel new, even though what she represents is kind of a classic kind of individual in like the pop climate.
Now, our listeners and New York Times readers also know you as the ethicist columnist for the magazine, where you write about what's good and what's right. How did you come to write this book about sort of the opposite?
I think all these things sort of coincided with each other. You know, the way I publish books with Scribner, and typically I sign 2 book contracts with them. I sign a contract for a nonfiction book and a fiction book. So I signed one of those deals, and I wrote a novel called The Visible Man, which is sort of a book with an unsympathetic main character. The follow-up to that was this book on villains. At the same time, I started writing The Ethicist, because what I found was in so many other things I was writing, I would do these long 5,000-word pieces about Tim Tebow with the whole goal of like getting to this one paragraph to talk about, the problem of faith in the modern age, or I would write about Nickelback and Creed for 3,000 words, and either to get to the problem of sort of hating things arbitrarily. So the ethicist seemed to provide this opportunity where the nut of the problem was the first thing I dealt with. Like someone presents a problem in their life, a pragmatic ethical dilemma, and then I just need to isolate what the dilemma is, and then sort of describe what I view as the most ethical response, which isn't all the time necessarily what I would do, but more so if an objective third party looks at this, how do they sort of rank how this is going to impact the people around them and the person themselves. So all of these things kind of happen at the same time, I feel like. I just kind of change as a person, and this is what I'm interested in now.
All right, well, we'll see which villain becomes, I guess, some kind of a quasi hero or anti-hero next. Thanks so much, Chuck.
Well, thanks for having me on.
That was Chuck Klosterman, author of I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. I am talking to Megan O'Rourke from Paris. She wrote an essay for this week's issue of the Book Review called Deadlines. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Pamela. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So what are you doing in Paris?
I'm here with the very difficult job of having to teach for a month with NYU in Paris. As you can imagine, it really feels horrible to have to come to Paris for a month in the summer and teach. No, it's been utterly lovely. So we're here with some undergrads, and we're teaching them poetry and introducing them to French literature.
You wrote an essay for us this week about what might be called the mortality memoir. Tell us about what your essay looks at.
So in the essay, I look at the fact that while, of course, death has always been, a, if not the great literary theme, there's been a kind of new turn in it. And of course, with every time you say there's been a new turn in something, you can find a million exceptions. But what's happening today that seems noteworthy is that writers are actually chronicling their own deaths and recording their own deaths as they happen, so that we have this kind of death as a literary theme that is both documentary and kind of in real time. So I'm thinking of books like Christopher Hitchens's Mortality, which was, of course, originally a series of columns for Vanity Fair. Even a book like Anatole Briard's Intoxicated by My Illness. You know, he was an editor of the Times Book Review and also wrote many essays about his own illness.
He was a daily critic at the Times.
And thank you for correcting me. And, you know, John Updike wrote poems about his own diagnosis from cancer, and Roger Ebert wrote about it. Marjorie Williams, the journalist, the Washington Post columnist, wrote a wonderful essay called The Woman at the Washington Zoo.
Also the title of her book.
Yes, exactly. So that's what I'm writing about, is this sort of writers, in some cases even novelists, turning to document death in real time.
You know, it is true, I think, that there has been a kind of uptick in these types of accounts. And part of me wonders if it dates to, in a weird way, that the book, The Last Lecture, that came out, I think, about 5 years ago or so, which started off as a piece in the Wall Street Journal, or I think it started off actually as an actual lecture and then became a kind of internet phenomenon. Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
I guess there's this idea that in that moment of dying or knowing that you're going to die, that you come to some kind of wisdom or conclusion about, you know, what does it all mean? Do you find that in these books, that there's that grappling with the big questions?
There's definitely the grappling with the big questions, but it is also the nature of literary writers to be much more skeptical than I think the man who wrote The Last Lecture was, right? I mean, it's sort of the nature of our writers to hold up this ideas like this, cultural ideas that in the last moment you find wisdom, and actually scrutinize them and ask them, you know, is this really true? And one of the things I talk about in my essay is that while they do look at this and examine this, you know, it's not necessarily the case that dying ennobles people, right? I mean, it does make you have to grapple with sort of the awful brevity of our lives. And one of the things that all of the books end up expressing in one way or another is paradoxically extreme shock at the fact that time is so short. I mean, we know that time is so short, and yet when one is diagnosed, it seems to be universally the case that you are just like, how did this happen already?
Right, it's like time collapses.
Right, and I actually was just reading Albert Camus' The Plague while I was here in Paris, and it's a book that he wrote during wartime, and it's sort of a book about war in a certain way, but as through the lens of illness, through the lens of a plague that comes to terrorize this town, and very much that's what he's writing about too, the fact that we live lives in the secular age, and most of the writers I'm talking about are secular, which is important, where it's very difficult for us to hold in mind the kind of deeper metaphysical realities of day-to-day life. And as secular writers, you know, these are not people who've been going to church all the time and sort of thinking about the afterlife. And so that's part of their subject matter too, is, you know, what do you do when faced with death? What kind of meaning do you find in a death when you don't necessarily believe anything comes after it? And that's a paradox for all of them.
I mean, I think obviously the biggest skeptic among these is probably Christopher Hitchens. And one of the things that you do find in Mortality is he sort of does that constantly stepping outside of himself and examining our assumptions about death. And, you know, he has this idea of that he's going to approach it in this sort of perfect, noble way, which then, of course, he has to constantly wrestle with when he's going through this very challenging illness and steep physical decline.
Absolutely. I mean, I just love this book. I think it's an extraordinary book. And actually, the very end of the book is a series of notes, which seems like kind of the perfect end, right? I mean, sort of the diminishment into the uncrafted essay. But Hitchens, you know, is very concerned about sentimentality and self-pity. He's, you know, he's his usual bracing, deeply observant self. And of course, one of the things that he's preoccupied with and that all these books are preoccupied with is the fact that we die in such a medicalized way.
Yes.
And one of the powerful questions he asks is like, is this medicalized death, like, is the extra time worth it? And at moments, you know, his answer is no, but then when he feels better, of course, his answer is yes, you know, it is worth it. But these books are, you know, they're unpleasant tours, but because they're such brilliant writers, you know, Updike and Hitchens, they're fascinating tours of what Hitchens calls tumor town, which is, you know, what it's like to live as somebody who is ill. And we do not, you know, in some centuries ago, the Romantics had obviously a very, you know, kind of romantic idea toward death. You know, Keats wrote, "Now more than ever, it seems rich to die, to seize upon the midnight with no pain." And that is not at all what these writers are saying, you know, saying what's left of me.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of become this kind of subgenre of the kind of screw you cancer memoir, where I think of, you know, the late Catherine Russell Rich, who wrote The Red Devil about her sort of first and second episodes with cancer, which ultimately killed her 20 years later. But in times they can be kind of comic, or very comic, and even Hitchens's book has its comic moments. But I thought also that it's interesting, Hitchens tried so hard to avoid that sentimentality and that self-pity, but the book itself is very touching.
Oh, absolutely. And I think partly because he's so, you know, hard on himself and so clear-eyed about the fact that, of course, this happens to everybody. So why is it a surprise? But it is a surprise when it happens to oneself.
Now, you, of course, wrote a memoir related to this about grieving, about being on the other side. Obviously, you're not dead or dying, but your mother passed away. How did reading these memoirs sort of affect you in terms of your own experience and what you wrote about?
Well, it's interesting. I ended up feeling that there was definitely a kinship between what I was doing and what they were doing, because I was writing about grief in real time. So I actually wrote a column in Slate about my mother, who had just died, and kind of tracked the trajectory of grief, which then became this book, The Long Goodbye. So it sort of was a funny parallel to the Hitchens book. And it definitely made me think about the fact that the internet is affording us all these possibilities in sort of dealing with emotional trajectories through writing, you know, in time. That's very interesting. You know, it was very painful to read these books, but also somewhat helpful. I mean, there was so much I recognized from the other side, from being the one watching somebody suffer. And I think in a way I was glad I didn't read them while my mother was ill, but I was glad to have read them now. And I just think that we have, you know, one of the great things that literature can give us is the possibility of shadowing another consciousness, right? So that in some ways I have a more intimate experience with Christopher Hitchens' attitude toward his own final months than to my own mother's, right? Because I'm able to shadow him in these essays. And that's a profound and powerful thing. And I think it's very needed in this day and age when we really hold death, you know, for understandable reasons, at an arm's length. So I found, you know, Updike's poems just incredibly moving, for example.
Well, then on that somewhat optimistic or uplifting note to a sad topic, Megan O'Rourke, thank you so much for joining us from Paris.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Megan O'Rourke talking about her essay Deadlines, which is in this week's issue of the New York Times Book Review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
So what excitement do we have on the list this week?
Well, we are moving into the sultry and steamy part of the summer, and so on the combined fiction list, half of the new titles are romances. Let's not talk about them. On the hardcover fiction list this week, there are four new titles. The highest ranked new title is at number 2. It is by our old friend James Patterson with his sometime collaborator Howard Ruffin, Rouchan. This is a book called Second Honeymoon. It's
not a romance, I guess.
It is called Second Honeymoon. It's a follow-up to a book they wrote called Honeymoon several years ago, but not quite a romance. There is a lot of sex in it, but there's also a lot of death. It's a serial killer novel. There's actually two serial killers in this book, and one of them targets newlywed couples, hence the honeymoon part of the title. Then at number 6 this week, the longtime thriller writer James Rollins, who writes the Sigma Force novels, has a new one of those out called The Eye of God. Then at number 7, Ellen Hildebrand, who writes, they're standalone novels, but they're all set on Nantucket Island, and she comes out with a book every summer, often about some kind of death or mystery on Nantucket. This one's actually about a Nantucket wedding that looks to go wrong when all the guests are having problems with their own marriages. It's called Beautiful Day.
So it's doomed romance on the hardcover list.
Yes, exactly. Finally, the last new title on the hardcover fiction list is by our sometime contributor, Curtis Sittenfeld. Her third best-selling novel, Sisterland, is new at number 12. That's about twins who have psychic powers.
And this is the follow-up to Prep and American Wife.
Yeah, it's actually her fourth novel, but Prep and American Wife both did make the bestseller list. Her second novel, Man of My Dreams, is the only one that did not. Then on the nonfiction hardcover list this week, there are two new titles, and they're both fairly low ranking. At number 14, Amir Thompson, who's better known as Questlove, the drummer and co-founder of the seminal hip-hop band Roots, which is also Jimmy Fallon's house band, has a memoir out called Mo Meta Blues, which he wrote with the New Yorker editor Ben Greenman.
Ben Greenman also has a relatively new novel out, The Slippage.
That's right, yes. He's written several books, and so he signed on as co-writer for Questlove's memoir, new at number 14. And then at number 16, Niall Ferguson has a book called The Great Degeneration. What's interesting about this book is, so Ferguson is a fellow at the Hoover Institute. He's kind of a right-wing commentator and philosopher, thinker. He's written several books of history and cultural commentary and criticism.
He's from the UK, but he's based here now, right?
Yes, that's right. I say right-wing. I mean, it's maybe not as extreme as right-wing, but he's certainly a conservative thinker. This book, The Great Degeneration, is kind of a look at the same thing that George Packer looks at in The Unwinding, which remains on the list at number 11 in its sixth week. Packer and Ferguson are both looking at the breakdown of institutions in the West, the economic collapse, kind of social and cultural breakdown. And Packer is really looking at it from the point of view of a leftist thinker, of a more liberal thinker, where Ferguson's looking at it from a more conservative thinker. But they both agree that things are just breaking down all around us.
So things are bad. At least we all know that.
Exactly.
Well, on that cheery note, thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.